On the show today, Rich and I are joined by journalist and music aficionado Mark Hemingway. We'll talk about Kanye West's gamble on the delivery of his next album, why physical music delivery made you more invested in the art form, and how modern artists make money. I'm your host, Brad Jackson, and you're listening to the February 21st, 2022 edition of Coffee & Co. Sean. Joining us now on Coffee & Co. Sean, I have Rich with me here as usual, and we are joined by a friend of ours, a writer in Washington, the one, the only Mark Hemingway is on the show. Mark, thanks so much for being here today.
Hey, glad to be here.
So this whole show came together because we, the three of us, were on this longer email chain about music today, and it was fascinating to me to sort of hear the struggles that artists have to go through today in order to make a buck. Because when you think about the music industry today, bands are constantly touring. They're at these big, giant festivals. It's easier than ever for you to listen to music. It's in your pocket. It's in your car. It's on your watch. It's everywhere. But it seems to me like it's really hard for a musician to make money these days. So to start us off here, why don't you just give us a rundown on how a band makes money today in the music industry?
Well, the short answer is they don't. I mean, it's always been difficult to make money as a musician. It's been a really, trying period of time, I would say, in the last decade or so when streaming services really sort of took off for musicians, because overnight, people that were dependent on money from royalties, whether they were songwriters and musicians, that income just sort of cratered. And whatever money they got from, record sales, obviously, had been diminishing for a while, and now it's just, practically non-existent. The streaming does provide revenue, but, it's fractions of a cent every time a song gets played. I mean, you can play tens of millions of streams, and it will amount to next to nothing, in terms of actual income. Like, you're probably not living off that. So about the only way that, artists make a living these days is that they tour and they perform and they get their money that way. But even now, like, the big record labels are, very keen for, young and eager bands and artists to sign what they call 360 deals, which is where basically, they own a part of any potential revenue stream that you might ever be involved in. And it's just, it's absolutely crazy. Whereas, tour merchandise and other things like that used to be, the band's money. Now all of a sudden the record label is getting a piece of the tour merchandise and all this other stuff that the band used to be able to count on as their own. So it's just a really, really ugly situation for musicians these days trying to earn a living.
I was in college actually studying music business when the MP3 revolution started, and it was a very interesting time because it seemed like it was going to be this huge liberator. It was a terrible time to be studying to go into the business, because you would go to class every day and, Sony laid off this many people, this label laid off this many people, and it really seemed like it was going to be this disruptor. But Mark, it seems like instead the industry just figured out how to go back to taking the lion's share of the money from these streaming services.
Well, to some extent, that is true. Like, so what happened was, is the labels, saw the writing on the wall in a way that the artists didn't, and they realized they had this huge bargaining chip with the streaming services. Well, let me just back up first. Let's address the first thing is, you're talking about the MP3 revolution here. Now, just because of the nature of music as a form of media, they were sort of the canary in the coal mine for the rest of what happened with the digitization of, physical media, which is to say that it was a lot easier to encode a single song into digital information and transmit it over the internet back in the 90s, starting in the 90s when bandwidths and other things like that were still limited. So, the widespread pirating of music and the immediate reality of what was going to happen to distribution channels for things that had previously been physical media, it was music that the purple people first, you know, that was the first industry to really be disrupted by piracy and, you know, digital distribution. And I don't think that the media really, I'm sorry, the music industry really handled that well at all. It's, you know, for those people that weren't alive in the 90s, it's impossible to describe to you how much just, you know, absolute utopian horse crap about the internet was out there. You know, the internet was going to save us all. You know, it was going to make everything more efficient economically. It was going to allow everyone to have a say in everything. And so while the internet was coming along and like massively disrupting the music industry's business model, everyone just assumed that there would be a light at the end of the tunnel. I think in terms of the music industry, the light at the end of the tunnel turned out to be a train. And so the music industry just like went along to go along with, you know, iPods and all these other things that were popping up, thinking that, oh, well, we'll just find a way out of this that will save the industry. Well, it didn't. It just disrupted the industry without, you know, as we know it, without, you know, replacing any of the traditional sources of revenue in terms of like record sales. And so the music industry by, you know, the mid late aughts was scrambling to figure out what was next. And then when streaming services came along, they realized that they had this big bargaining chip to like, you know, get, you know, back into the game in terms of where the music industry was headed, which is say they own these huge catalogs of music that they had the rights to. So they realized that if streaming services were going to, you know, pop up and start, you know, doing this sort of thing where they distributed, you know, music, then they negotiated themselves, you know, equity deals with these big, you know, streaming services that ended up, you know, sort of dominating the market. And so what happens is the music industry's, you know, income and livelihood these days is largely dependent on weird, you know, like stock prices and things like that, not necessarily record sales. And so I think it really distorts how music gets, you know, made and marketed.
Mark, let me ask this, though. If you're a band today, if you're an up-and-coming band and you haven't signed on a major label yet, what's the incentive to do that? Because you can tour yourself. You can distribute music yourself now. You can, I mean, it used to be that you'd go to these labels to get studio time and to do all that sort of thing. But these days the technology exists for you to make an album, a good sounding album in your home on a decent computer with boards and everything. I mean, get all that stuff these days. You can make a home studio for relatively cheap, record an album yourself, distribute it yourself. What's the point of signing on a big label? What does that get you?
I mean, I think that's the question a lot of people are asking themselves these days. And certainly for certain, you know, genres of music, that if you're not like some sort of pure, you know, lowest common denominator, you know, big time pop act, you know, you're Justin Bieber's, you're, you know, I don't know, who's the red haired guy from England? I always forget. You know, one of those guys, Taylor Swift's, you know, when there's not like, you know, I don't think there's a real incentive to do that because, you know, as I pointed out, you know, almost all your revenue is going to come from, you know, touring. And, you know, so it's really just a question of how much a label can offer you in terms of promotion, basically, in terms of, you know, the access they have to getting your music out there. The other thing is that, you know, the ecosystem for, say, like music magazines and other things that used to be very influential in pushing music and stuff like that, that has also been disrupted by the internet. So it's really an open question, you know, what kind of influence the music industry has on those things. I mean, I do think that there are certain, you know, LA-centric music labels, you know, still have influence in a lot of ways, you know, with satellite radio and other places. And, you know, they certainly, depending on what kind of artist you are and other things, can offer you some benefit if you choose to go that way. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the access to studios and other things like that is a lot easier. Although, you know, one of the big things I think that the crumbling of the music industry has also affected lots of other things in terms of, you know, there's a big difference now between, say, recording an album on your laptop. You know, it can sound pretty decent. And, you know, back in the day when a band could, you could go in, like, you know, I think Def Leppard famously spent, I don't remember, like several million dollars recording Hysteria. They spent, like, you know, days recording chords that were like one string at a time and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. And I'm sorry, whatever you want to say, that that record sounds absolutely incredible. And the decline of, say, you know, big studios and recording time and trained recording engineers has been a real blow to the industry as well. I mean, just, you know, nobody, not having that kind of, you know, centralized, you know, cash flow, definitely, I'm sorry, it's definitely hurt the industry in certain ways, even as it's improved things in other ways. And they're not necessarily controlling what you get to listen to, and you have more music at your fingertips than ever.
So you bring up a good point, Mark, about the quality of recording and how the digitization and the switch to streaming, it's changed how music is mixed. And it's even evident for those of us who still have CDs, who listen to a physical CD in our house and then maybe throw the same album on via Spotify in our car. It's a different experience. So can you tell us a little bit about how sonically this shift to streaming has changed the music industry?
Yeah. So when you take analog, when you record something using sort of analog sources, you know, I don't know exactly how you wanted to find this. I mean, this stuff gets really murky fast, you know, stuff involving, say, vacuum tubes back in the day, or, you know, just the electrical signals, you know, literally like cutting grooves into vinyl or, and then things like that. There is a, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, there's definitely sort of a warmth and a feeling of dynamics that is not necessarily that there when you record things digitally. So what happens is you have to, when you translate something from an analog source into digital, you're literally taking that, you know, actual signal that you've recorded, you know, however you want in the physical world, and you're converting all of that information at its most base level into ones and zeros. Like, you can literally take a song that's on a CD and, you know, however many thousands or millions of ones and zeros it would take to encode that song, you can literally be translated into ones and zeros. And obviously, when you do something that drastic, you're losing out on things. You know, Brad mentioned that he still likes to buy his music. I mean, I have about 4,000 vinyl LPs in my house. And yeah, I listen to Spotify all the time.
Way to
because
go.
It's, yeah, I listen to Spotify all the time because it's convenient when I'm at my computer or when I'm, you know, out and about. There's absolutely no substitute. Sit down and listen to something that's been compressed and converted into digital, and then, you know, put on an old record, you know, through a decent sound system with good speakers, you know. Granted, it really has to be a decent sound system, you know, for you to notice much difference. And if you're just listening through headphones or, you know, God forbid, AirPods or something, then, you know, it doesn't matter that much. But if you actually care about music and you care about the experience, you really want to listen to it in some sort of more analog format. And the most important way that I think you notice these things is in terms of dynamics, in terms of, you know, when music gets soft versus loud, in terms of, you know, how it when I'm listening to vinyl record, it feels more like I'm in the room with the musicians than it does when it's on digital. And even people who aren't, you know, super, you know, hi-fi, you know, geeks or anything, I think sense that when they're forced to immediately listen to them back to back.
So Mark, that brings up a good question. Do kids today who grow up in a world that where they only experience music digitally, particularly only experience music, you know, on their AirPods or whatever, or in their car, where it's a very transitory thing. It's not sitting down listening to an album from start to finish on a record or even on a tape or whatever. You know, like today you can just skip through music, go from genre to genre, song to song, just instantly. Do they appreciate music like those of us who are older do? Because I feel like my kids don't understand what it takes to make that music because it's just so transitory for them.
So they do and they don't. I mean, I think that for, you know, most casual music fans that are young, that, you know, grew up post-internet, they don't really care. It's just, you know, whatever's convenient, you know, and whatever makes them feel good and whatever they enjoy. It's just, it's right there at their fingertips and they don't even think about it. I do think it's interesting though, that the people that really are music fans that are of a younger generation, there's this distinct feeling that they're missing something. And I've noticed this repeatedly. So like I play guitar, and so, you know, going like guitar forums on the internet and other things like that. And, there will, you know, you'll look at, well, like kids that are like teenagers today, like what they're interested in, like in terms of, you know, guitar, and they're talking about the Red Hot Chili Peppers and, you know, Led Zeppelin and stuff. And, you know, part of that is just, you know, well, maybe guitar music is dead as a form, but it's also true that they just sense that there was something more authentic and more pure that was happening then. And like, I don't think I'm imagining this in some like, you know, middle-aged get off my lawn kind of way. You know, they could sense that this kind of thing was much more central to the culture rather than just being this disposable commodity where everyone could, you know, pull up, you know, the next thing, you know, in 5 seconds without, you know, having to invest in sitting down to listen to an album, without having to spend, you know, $20 to buy a CD.
Well, isn't that the thing though? Because for our generation, you had to save up your money to go buy music. And then when you got that music, you would take it home and listen to it, however that was, whether it was, you know, on vinyl or on tape or whatever, or even on CD. And you would sit there and you'd turn everything else off. You'd block out the rest of the world and you just sit and experience that music. And I don't think kids today understand that because it's just so instant. It's like fast food music as opposed to like sitting down and having like a 5-star meal music.
I think that's an excellent point. You know, but the other thing is you were like literally invested in the music, right?
Right.
So if I spent $18 on a CD 30 years ago, which I don't know what that would be in terms of inflation, but you know, it was real money as a teenager, and I'd go home and I put that CD on and I didn't like it right away, well, it'd be like, well, you know, I need to make sure that I'm not missing something or whatever. So you would like invest in the album in terms of like you listen to it multiple times or whatever. And you would try and, you know, actively understand what was going on with the music because, you know, you had invested in it literally. You know, you didn't want to be stuck. I remember, you know, the times I would buy these records that I didn't like and I'd be like so angry about it because, you know, I didn't have that much money. I remember I bought Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill record because I had read that Dave Navarro of the Red Hot Chili Peppers and like some other cool musicians had played on that record. And I was thinking, oh, well, this would be good. And I remember like the sinking feeling after a day or two of having the record to realize that I absolutely hated it. Then like, I was like angry about it. you know, I don't know. I mean, there's something to be, you know, said for that album, you know, perhaps, but you know, as a, you know, 19 year old guy or whatever I was at the time, like it just was not my thing. And I remember being really angry that I'd spent the money on it. And, I feel like you're right. You know, kids, they don't listen. They don't think of, artists, you know, as people that put out like larger statements, like albums. They don't think about like where the artist is coming from. It's literally just, you know, does this music make me feel good or not? Which, you know, is not a bad thing. I mean, everybody loves the visceral impact of music, but it's not like the highest level of appreciating art by any stretch of the imagination. And kids aren't being conditioned to listen to like, you know, really intellectual stuff. I mean, you know, prog was really popular in the 70s. I mean, it's really hard to imagine, you know, really sophisticated music breaking through the din and of streaming services these days.
So I have recently started listening to more vinyl, and something that it's forced me to do is I've realized that really the downfall kind of started with CDs. And for those of us who had grown up pre-CD, the CD seemed so revolutionary, but it gave us an option to hit a fast forward button. So like today, if I'm listening to an album and maybe it gets to a song that isn't my favorite on the album, it's a lot of trouble to pick up the needle and move it and get it in the precise location. So it's easier for me to just sit there and listen. And so I'm more invested, and it makes the payoff of when I do get to that song that I really like, it's better because it's part of the cohesive album. And so that's kind of a weird setup to what started this whole conversation. So Kanye West's next album, Donda 2, is not going to be released on any streaming services. It's only going to be released on his own device, Stim, which I initially thought was just another service, but it's actually a physical device where users can mess with it and you can kind of live mix it while you listen to the song. It's the way it's done, it's all digitally separated. So you can pull the bass out, or you can pull the vocals out, or you can hit repeat or whatever. So I guess in closing, what do you think, that this is just a crazy idea that Kanye has, or do you think there might be something to this that gets younger people who fork out the $200 to buy his device to get them more focused on the actual music, because it's taking the activity they would normally be doing with their hands and, you know, being on their phone while they listen, and instead they're using it to control this device?
So to what you were saying about the vinyl listening experience, if you listen to the CD of Tom Petty's Full Moon Fever, which is the album that has Free Falling and a whole bunch of other big hits on it, that album came out in 1989. And 1989-88 was right around the time when vinyl LPs were quite definitively being shoved out of record stores in favor of CDs. But, you know, they were still kind of around, but they were, it was pretty clear they were on the way out. And halfway through that record, there's a whole thing where Tom Petty inserts this thing where he's like, you know, he comes onto the CD with his voice. He's like, now is the time where if you were listening to a vinyl record, you would have to get up and you would have to, you know, come over and flip the record. And I don't remember exactly what he says, but he makes this point of like reminding the listeners that that's what they would be doing at this point if they weren't listening to the CD. And it's really interesting to me, like, you know, Tom Petty later went on to do a record called The Last DJ, where, you know, he sort of lamented the death of the music industry in the late 90s. And it's really interesting to me how, like, you know, some artists like Tom Petty, like, really saw what was happening in terms of, you know, these format changes from LP, first from vinyl to CD, and then, you know, later on in terms of what was happening in the record industry, in the radio industry and some other things, and really sensed that the interaction of people's the people had with the physical medium, or, you know, their, you know, the way that the industry worked was affecting how listeners perceived music, and not for the better, at least, you know, in Tom Petty's clear conclusion. So in terms, which brings us to Kanye, which is to say, the physical involvement of, you know, even just having to get up out of your chair and flip a record over, I mean, it requires a degree of like active participation in music listening, that, you know, wandering around with your AirPods permanently in and hitting, you know, skip, fast forward, whatever, just doesn't do. And so to the extent that Kanye is trying to do something like wholly original, where he's even to the point where he's, you know, requiring people to buy, I guess, like a separate device and they can remix it or do all kinds of crazy things with the player, he's asking people to like interact with the music in a very active way. And yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of arty pretension to the particular way that he's going about it, but, you know, Kanye is not an idiot. I mean, he's a strange guy, but he's smart enough to realize that, like, this is the problem anymore. Like, people don't invest in music like they once did, both intellectually, financially, whatever it is. People need to be actually invested in music, you know, to really care about it. And he's trying to force the issue with what he's doing here. Now, whether or not spending $200 on a single album is going to, you know, win over a lot of hearts and minds here, I don't know. But I do know that Kanye's heart is in the right place, and he senses, and I think he's accurately diagnosed the problem with the solution he's proposed.
So, Mark, let's go out on this. What does the music industry look like in 10 years?
Huh. That is a really good question. I mean, honestly, I don't think it looks a lot different than it does currently. The problem here, though, is that we're not producing any new big musicians of note. You know, the few big musicians that pop up here and there are few and far between. And, you know, I'm sorry, I don't hate, say, I don't know, Olivia Rodrigo or whatever, but, you know, I don't think anyone's going to be talking that much about her in 40 years' time. And when I say the music industry is going to look the same, like, I mean, I think, honestly, it's going to look the same in terms of people will still be looking back toward the same, you know, I think that music from the 90s and before that is going to still be dominating popular culture, which I think is a really bad thing in terms of, you know, overall cultural health. I mean, I'm, you know, as a aging Gen X guy. I mean, I guess I'm fine with that, but I don't have a lot of hope for what that says about our country culturally.
Well, you know, one thing I've noticed is that Nirvana has gotten a lot of play lately. I think that's interesting.
It's really amazing to me. I mean, again, it's like the internet completely broke our sense of time. And one thing that was interesting is, like, you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, like, you know, music, and not just music, but a lot of the cultural things, like, you know, moved in terms of, like, there would be movements of things. So, like, I was a kid in high school in the Pacific Northwest in the early 1990s, graduated from high school in 1994, like, at the height of grunge. And you can imagine, like, what a thing that was, you know, in terms of how it defined you, who I was culturally and my relationship to the culture. You know, now you just don't see those kinds of movements within popular culture. Like, everything just bleeds into one in terms of, no, the previous generation isn't able to sort of distinguish themselves to, you know, versus private, the previous, sorry, current generations aren't able to distinguish themselves versus previous generations in terms of, you know, what cultural movements they participated in. You know, they can't really, like, assert themselves culturally in a positive way. And I just, because everything in the internet is just a jumble of influences anymore, and there's no, like, sort of linear progressions. But, you know, it's also true that we over-romanticize the past. I mean, you know, prior to grunge coming in and shaking up the music industry, I mean, you got to remember, you know, radio in the late 80s was just kind of a hellscape where you had your choice between, you know, I don't know, Whitney Houston or classic rock, and there was, like, little in between, and it wasn't always great. So, you know, there is some benefits to be had for, you know, having all the selection at your fingertips, but it is, I want to live in a fertile cultural environment where, you know, I'm looking at the younger generation producing these, you know, captivating artists and other things that speak to their generation, and it's just not happening. It's just, everything's just a jumble of influences and memes or something. It's weird.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great having you here. We appreciate it.
Glad to be on.